I'm overwhelmed, as a matter of fact. And I'm rather fearful of my inability to maintain such a high rating.
That's Secretary of State George Catlett Marshall, and he's giving a speech at Harvard University on June 5th, 1947, outlining the Marshall Plan, a $13 billion program to rebuild Europe after the ravages of World War II. Marshall said in his speech that the very massive facts presented to the public by press and radio make it exceedingly difficult for the man in the street to reach a clear appraisement of the situation. But here at Follow Your Ears, we'd like to give it a shot. Giving aid to nations and people who desperately need help has been an American staple for more than a century. Yet in 2013, aid has become more beholden to red tape and incompetence than ever before.
Again, I want to thank you all for, and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. The FEMA director's working 24.
This week, we go to Staten Island to talk with the organizers and volunteers of Occupy Sandy to find out how they helped people when others could not. We talk with Jonathan Katz, the only full-time American journalist stationed in Haiti during the 2010 earthquake, and reveal how billions of dollars given by Americans to help the impoverished ended up in the wrong place. My name is Edward Champion, and this is Follow Your Ears, Episode 4, Aid.
Right now we're kind of empty, but we usually have 10 generators and compressors and everything, so. But basically that's all I really do here, is like I just handle the tool library, handle the books, make sure that, you know, everybody signs what they sign in and what they sign out. We did have a free store across the way where we were giving out, you know, food and blankets and all that other stuff, but we did close it down for the next 2 weeks because we're moving everything over to the church where they're giving, we're starting to set up for getting mold out of people's houses and then sheetrock and all through donations. And it was just a bigger area over there for us to work with.
That's Gene, and he's the first guy I meet when I walk into the main Occupy Sandy supply hub on Staten Island. Occupy Sandy emerged in the aftermath of last year's hurricane. Aid wasn't moving fast enough, so Occupy Sandy stepped in and has been hard at work ever since. It's run by many of the same people who participated in the Occupy Wall Street movement. And as Gene tells me, Occupy Sandy took on an operational ethos of its own.
Then when Hurricane Sandy hit, it was just seemed to me to be the natural, you know, to us, the natural thing. And everybody in Occupy, we've been doing mutual aid now for an entire year and a half. I mean, we did it in the park. We had free food, free clothing, free shelter, which was basically tents, but that was all we had at the time, and free education. We had a library with 5,000 books, and two guys with a PhD would sit down and actually hold classes and teach anybody, you know, whatever they wanted to know. We had a free medical tent with two on-staff doctors open 24 hours a day, and basically we built, that was the infrastructure of that whole protest, was actually us building mutual aid and showing that, look, the government's not going to save you. Nobody's going to save us. The banks aren't going to come swooping in with a ton of money and say, hey, guys, we feel your pain. And we had seen it. And it just took one bad thing to happen for everybody else to kind of realize, hey, man, they're going to mess. They're really screwing with us.
Why do you think, ultimately, the government could not organize or mobilize nearly as much as you guys did with Sandy?
Well, here's the difference. And this is the big difference. Is one, we don't allow political parties. A person in that room could be a Democrat or Republican or a communist or an anarchist or whatever. We don't allow that to stop us from our primary purpose. We don't get caught up in all that. So we see a problem, we see a need, we all gather together and fix that need. This other stuff that we discuss, like how can we make, you know, politics better and all this other stuff, that's stuff that we kind of like do in our off time. We sit in around, we're all just discussing, you know, hey, what's a better idea? What's a better way of doing this? We're constantly trying to learn. You know, we're constantly connected through the internet with everybody all over the place.
Gene directs me into an adjacent room.
Please help yourselves. There's two cheese pizzas, a pepperoni, and a spinach and mushroom. So whenever you're hungry, it's here for you.
As you can hear, it's lunchtime. There are volunteers sitting around a collection of tables arranged in a square. They brought their own laptops, and they're plugging in data from a recent neighborhood canvas. The tone is remarkably quiet, almost like a church. I talked with Kay Goda, one of the coordinators of this project.
So today we're doing a data entry session. What we did was We're affiliated with Occupy Sandy,
yeah.
And we worked with members of the community out here to organize a 120-person door-to-door canvas with a form, a paper form, which pretty much asked them, you know, some basic top-line questions about, do you have electricity, do you need medical attention, do you have food needs, things like that. Collecting that data in paper form was the first step. The second step is actually getting into a digital format so we can do something with it.
Yeah.
So what we're doing today is we took all those forms, we scanned them, and now we have people doing manual labor, which is just looking at the forms and entering into a database. Yeah. Taking that database, then we're able to elevate it to a level where it's anonymizing the residents' names and numbers and things, but it's giving a general view of what's going on in Staten Island, like who doesn't have electricity, who does need food, who does need muckouts and repairs. We work together with a coalition of five other organizations, including Project Hospitality, Project Hope, and others, based on social services across Staten Island for what are the big questions. And everybody has like a deep form they want to answer. So the way we kind of address it is you go out and first you find out what services are needed, and then the secondary and third level canvases will be specific to those services. For example, do you need medical needs can be achieved by a bunch of church volunteers that came out in awesome numbers and did the first run. The second one would be actual doctors going out and medical practitioners and saying, okay, now I'm going to interview and figure out what do you really need. So it kind of optimizes what we've been trying to do and a lot of other organizations have been trying to do, which is get as much data as possible and help, but it does it in a more organized format. So,
why do you think there's not so much media attention to Staten Island?
I don't know. I focused predominantly, I started doing Sandy recovery work full time November 4th, right after the storm. I focused predominantly on the Rockaways initially for the first 4 or 5 weeks, and now I'm spreading out into other areas. Goldie and others and Ilya have been here since the beginning of the storm. So in terms of media attention, I know that we've had media down here. I'm not sure why it's fallen off the radar, because it's still a very serious issue, if not just for now, but honestly for the next 10 years, it's going to be an issue. So I don't have a good answer to that question. I wish it was different, but I don't have a good answer. Why can't people get the help they need? I think the people, you know, for storm situations, it's not a set process anyway, so it's that people don't know where to go. Another is that, you know, a lot of people want to help. Getting it organized in a way where people are talking to each other and having open access to data is very important as well. A lot of groups are going out and collecting data and keeping it mildly insular in what they do. Our goal is to create data sets and databases that everybody can access. Again, without the personal information exposed, unless it's needed, but it's more about like, okay, this area needs 50 doctors today.
So once you've actually entered all the data, it's going to be publicly available.
Yes.
I could actually download a PDF or a CVS or something.
Yes,
wow.
CSV, yeah. It's two levels of it. One is public to the world to figure out what's going on in different areas on a grand scale, and it goes through granular levels, and then the most granular level is, for example, I'll keep on using medical because that's a pretty sensitive issue. Medical professionals who are trained to handle that data, they get access to the data specifically. So you expose resident personal information when it needs to be, including to the residents themselves so they can have records for themselves. And you expose top-level information so, you know, large organizations can actually figure out what's happening on the ground.
The operation works in large part because volunteers are immediately given something to do. You learn the ropes faster than Humphrey Van Weyden picked up by the ghost.
It's ad hoc in nature, so there's no barrier to entry. For instance, you know, you can come in here, you can walk in and you can say, I am with Occupy Sandy doing media relations. And that's what you do. And you learn the network and you begin to understand who does what. And so it makes the network more resilient because small pieces can operate independently from the large. They don't need permission. So we saw a lot of, with FEMA, with Red Cross, with the National Guard, with the city, there's a lot of situations where we would say, okay, we're going to go into this building in canvas, and they would say, well, we have to check in with superiors, or we need to follow these certain procedures. And without that bureaucracy holding us back, it's simply individuals working as a network of individuals to get things done.
So it's largely a matter of red tape.
I'd say, yeah, red tape, and just pure bureaucracy. You know, from what I've heard, FEMA, you know, there's the people on the ground, there's boots on the ground, and then there's people up top, and they both, from both ends, see that it's an organization that doesn't work very well because of the glut in the middle.
How many hours would you say you devote to this each week?
I don't know, 40 plus easily. It's what I do pretty much full time.
What else do you do besides this?
I do web design, so I make websites and do consulting just to pay the rent. And you know, hopefully this kind of work will actually be worth something at some point. It's, you know, it's very troubling because when I, right as I was getting started with Sandy, I was working, you know, getting paid a really good amount of money to make a men's underwear website, and yet paid nothing to do work that actually had impact on people's lives and, you know, did good.
A lot of people have a hard time asking for help. In an individualistic society, we have that. You'll have that. And so it's...
Why do you think that is? Why is help such a difficult thing to deal with in terms of asking for or even eking it?
I think that there is an emphasis in our culture to be independent. And there is misinformation in the mainstream that if people need help, that they're somehow inadequate or...
They feel ashamed.
Exactly. Yep. It's not like that with everyone, but we're dealing with a community that is very blue-collar, a lot of very hard-working people. It's just hard. It's just hard to go to a door and be like, hey, we're here to help you, because they've been canvassed by so many other organizations, and like they've probably answered a million questions already trying to get assistance. So our emphasis...
Your questionnaire was probably a lot simpler than other ones.
We tried to keep it simple, and our questions and our training, the canvassers really emphasized, keep it conversational. And this is about mutual aid. This is about, like, creating connections. Anybody can come into this Occupy Sandy space and, hang out and help out. If we can connect neighbors, with neighbors, we found that a lot of the neighbors had very tight-knit, which was great. The most beautiful part I felt of this canvas was at the very end. We asked them if they wanted to attend a community meeting. I have not ran into a single completed survey where the person said that they didn't want to attend. They all want to attend a community meeting. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to make this a more communal effort. And people, the residents in the affected areas, seem to be really happy with that.
You have to remember why you're there. Know you're there to meet families that in a different emotional state of mind. Some have lost not only their homes, but have death in their family. And so before you approach them, you need to be sensitive to it and be open-minded to anger, resentment. It's not about you. The resentment is not towards you. They're not angry with you. They're angry with the situation. And so you have to first be human and be sensitive and just listen. That's what I did that Saturday on the 19th. Some homes we got to, they slammed doors in our faces. And no, because they're giving up. It's you're just here to make me repeat everything I've done already. Help is not really there. And so you just have to listen. And then speak, but you have to listen.
I've been really curious. One of the reasons I'm doing this program is to understand why a lot of aid efforts fail, such as the post-earthquake Haiti situation. Do you have any thoughts on why a lot of aid efforts don't work out? That why they don't people don't get the money or the help that they need in order to survive?
I'm not sure exactly the reason why it happens, but I think for some family, they just don't know where help is. They do not have the resources, don't have the information needed to seek help. And I believe those who know tend to find it. So I'm not sure exactly for each family what it is, but on a general, aspect, it's not really realizing that the help is out there.
But even if the help is out there, what guarantees are there to make sure that it gets into the right hands? Jonathan Katz was the only full-time American correspondent in Haiti when the devastating earthquake hit in 2010. His new book, The Big Truck That Went By, documents what happened in the quake's aftermath and reveals how despite $15 billion in donations, it didn't always find its way to the people of Haiti.
So, Haiti
has, from my understanding, a fairly nightmarish history, which you also bring up in the book. I mean, we're talking about a country that had the Taino genocide. We're talking about a country that had slavery, a rocky presidential history that has included assassinations, corruption. We're talking about a country that has deforestation, poverty. The list goes on. So
you obviously work for the Tourism Bureau. I think.
I do. But it's a marvelous place. So I have to ask you, aside from introducing more competence into the jukebox, you know, how can outsiders best understand Haiti as a nation and as a culture? Has the reaction to the quake through aid workers been any different at all from pre-quake reactions?
No, it hasn't. And in fact, I think part of the reaction was poisoned by a negative perception of Haiti. Everything you say, by the way, is absolutely true. All those things really are in its history. You know, I, first of all, as a history student in undergrad, I certainly would have never shied away from negative parts of a country's past. And then certainly as the Associated Press correspondent in Haiti, I was accused routinely and correctly of writing a lot of bad news all the time. But at the same time, you talk about any country in the world, you could write a history of France and go through the same thing. Constant revolutions, bloody rebellions, corrupt presidents who crown themselves emperor. You know, it's not particular to one kind of country or another. Now, that said, there are some major systemic structural problems in Haiti. But frankly, and one of the things I'm trying to get at in the book is that one of the structural problems is the structure of Haiti's relationship with the outside world. I mean, it's a very unbalanced relationship. It's often a very paternalistic relationship. And there's really no better example than the earthquake, than the response to the earthquake. Foreign governments were and donors and aid groups were coming in with their own plans. They didn't really care all that much about what Haitians wanted for themselves or how Haitians saw their own circumstances. They came in with the attitude that we know what to do. You just stand out of the way and we'll get it done. And it caused a lot of problems. And there are a whole bunch of examples.
Well, perhaps you should describe them for people who have not read the book.
Sure, of course. I can give you a couple examples. For instance, there was a perception that search and rescue was a necessary priority of the greatest priority of the response, because there was a supposition that essentially nobody would be doing rescues on the ground themselves. And the irony was that even though the rescuers were, I have to say, extremely brave people who came and did extremely heroic work, and the lives they saved are priceless, coming in from the outside to a disaster zone takes time. It took 24 hours basically for the first search and rescue teams to start arriving, which, if you're pinned under concrete, is an extremely long period of time. In that interim, the people who were doing the rescues were neighbors, they were friends, they were people who were passing by, they were relatives, they were Haitians saving Haitians. And it's something that was overlooked internationally. And part of the cost of overlooking that was that when they came in, they assumed that the foreigners assumed that they would figure out on their own where to go and rescue people, how to carry out the rescues, and so ended up concentrating on just a couple of sites that happened to be very well known to foreigners that they felt that they could secure, because another one of their errors was assuming that they were an extremely violent place, which is a bit of an overstatement. And it also means that in the long run, we haven't thought about what Haiti really needs in terms of disaster response, which is homegrown agencies on the ground, government institutions, and even private institutions that, when a disaster strikes, would be capable of responding and taking care of themselves. I mean, that's one example, and there are a lot of others, and I'll just briefly one more, is that one of the long-term goals in Haiti has been to decentralize the country, because so many people have been moving to the capital over the years that the capital was wildly overcrowded. It's a city that estimates were built in terms of infrastructure to hold no more than, some people say 50,000, some people say 250,000. There were 3 million people on the morning of the earthquake. One of the long-term goals has been to move people out of the city. Well, ironically, the earthquake did have a silver lining at first because people left. An estimated 600,000 people went out and spontaneously decongested the capital in a way that had been dreamt about for decades. But when the responders came in, they weren't paying attention to that. They weren't thinking about that. They weren't thinking about the fact that Haiti was a much bigger place than just Port-au-Prince. They concentrated their aid and response in the capital, and people responding to that moved back. And an opportunity to decongest the capital and prevent another disaster like the earthquake was missed.
Let's touch upon what you were saying in the first part of this answer. The response from outsiders was very much predicated on the idea that all was chaos. You bring up Rebecca Solnit's A Paradise Built in Hell in the book, pointing out this interesting thesis that after most disasters, there's this time where everybody is fairly calm, people are conciliatory, people help each other out. What's the disconnect in communication? Is it simply the disconnect in being able to get people there immediately? What accounts for this, do you think?
There's a number of things, and Rebecca Solnit's book is brilliant. It's a really great accounting of this, and it's a demonstration that this is not a problem that is unique to Haiti, or even unique to poor countries, or even unique to situations in which one country or a group of countries is coming to help another one. You see the same thing in the United States. You saw the same thing in New York after Superstorm Sandy. There was a presumption on the part of a lot of people that there was going to be looting, there was going to be panic, there was going to be chaos, that what we needed were curfews, we needed an aggressive quasi or paramilitaristic response on the part of the police in order to keep the population under control. And it was interesting. I read Rebecca's book for the first time while I was working on my own. And so it was actually, and in reading it, I was like, oh yeah, this is exactly what we experienced.
You got the checklist. You're checking off the points.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, you know, I'm reading it, you know, and I was reading her accounting, and in fact, I had even before I had read her book, I had already gone back a little bit archivally and read like Jack London's newspaper accounts of the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. Which she also talks about that disaster. And in all those cases, over and over again, it's like, oh yeah, this is the same thing. It's the same thing. It's a situation where, you know, people who are not in the disaster themselves or are not as affected by the disaster or who are elite in the sense that they have a lot to lose. They've got a lot of money. They've got a lot of power. You know, they've got their home that they're very concerned about, and they're suspicious of the people around them. They come in and assume that people are going to behave badly, that, you know, my God, you know, underneath society there is this Hobbesian chaos always waiting to break through, and all it needs is an excuse, and this earthquake must have provided that excuse. And it leads to very bad outcomes. In the case of Haiti, it led to a military-led response that was predicated on the notion of command and control, which is just how the military operates. It means that, you know, you've got a commander in one spot. He's got his base. He's got his adjutants, and they're giving orders. And you know, the individual companies are going out and performing the mission and then coming back. In Haiti, that led to an over-centralization of the response. Again, that's part of the reason why decentralization and deconcentration didn't happen. And it also left huge gaps. It left huge areas of the quake zone, not to mention the country outside of the quake zone, unattended.
Well, I mean, I want to actually talk also about this kind of misinformation and hysteria. You go into it a couple of times in the book. I mean, what we think we know about Haiti comes from what people say they know about Haiti. There's this interesting overview of Sean Penn's effort to save this 15-year-old boy named Oriel. And he appears on Anderson Cooper 360, and he shrieks about Haiti's dying en masse, and he overstates the diphtheria problem, as you point out in the book. And then you have this cholera epidemic, and the UN's Vincenzo Pugliese and a waste disposable contractor named Sanko, they participate in what New York Times health reporter Donald G. McNeil Jr. has identified as the blame game. Why do you think this disparity continues to happen? And why has it continued to go on for so long, especially in this age when we're supposed to be technologically connected, when a guy like you is there busting his ass to try to get genuine, true information about what's really happening in Haiti? How can this continue to happen? And how does this hysteria fan the flames? And how is it harmful towards outsiders' efforts to know what Haiti really needs?
Perceptions die hard. I mean, our notions about one another, unspoken or otherwise, they're hard to eliminate. And even, you know, a simple news story or a bunch of news stories or a book aren't going to undo, you know, generations of sentiment and preconceived notions about one another. One of the preconceived notions about Haiti is that it is a diseased place. This is in the book as well. There's a moment not long after the earthquake when a bunch of the foreign journalists who'd come in were all sitting around the pool at the Hotel Villa Creole. Not to make this sound nicer than it was, the pool was cracked in the bottom and there's debris floating in it. We weren't relaxing. It's just the open location where there was room. And they were passing around a sheet of paper onto which the game was that everybody would write one word that described Haiti. And I remember very clearly one of the words was diseased. And, you know, somebody wrote disgusting. And it is true that when you go to Haiti, there's no good sewer system. There's no good trash collection system, especially in Port-au-Prince. There's tons of trash on the street. It smells. You know, you go into a slum where people have to do their business in a canal or out in the open, and it smells like it. And it is not a sanitary place, and it is you know, it's certainly not Scandinavia or Japan, but that doesn't mean that the people are just sort of like inherent spontaneous generators of disease, right? And so one of the notions, and this is a larger misconception in disaster response, is that after a disaster of any kind, there will intrinsically follow an epidemic. It's wrong. Scientists from the World Health Organization, from there was a good study published in the Emerging Infectious Diseases from the CDC. Scientists find over and over again that link is way, way overstated. So that ties in both of the examples you just talked about. Sean Penn, new in Haiti, has an incredible amount of power based on his fame and his cachet, frankly, his race, his gender. I mean, all kinds of other things are going on there as well. But, you know, he's able to come into Haiti and basically
living in luxury at the golf course as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's got a much nicer place than most other people who are living at the golf course. Certainly, he's not living. He was living a life more or less like mine. And you know, and I
blonde's the pair of you.
Yeah, you know, there's great rum. There's, you know, good places to hang out even after the earthquake. You know, things started opening up again. You know, it wasn't terrible. But anyway, like, you know, he's there and he has a tremendous amount of responsibility as an aid worker, a genuine aid worker, and full credit to him. The man is no dilettante. He's not a celebrity who just comes for a photo op. Like, he was there and he was real. And what he really was an aid worker who at the beginning was in completely over his head.
Yeah.
And he sees this case as a tragic case. It's a 15-year-old boy who dies. He's understandably very upset. But he basically resurrects this notion that, you know, it's this combination of this perception that there's going to be an epidemic because there's been a disaster, and especially in Haiti because Haiti is such a diseased or a disease-prone place.
One thing lost in the equation, I should point out, just for people who don't know, that he goes ahead and is trying to get a vaccine for this boy and is knocking and is using his influence and is telephoning left and right and finally gets the warehouse open to get the vaccine. The antitoxin, I apologize. And so as a result, this is part of what informs his ranting on Anderson Cooper.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, and two brief things about that. His ability to rally the troops and bring in the cavalry for this kid, even though it didn't end up doing the job, is something that even another aid worker, you know, anybody short of probably Bill Clinton wouldn't have been able to do, which is, you know, great for the kid, although it's a severe imbalance of resources. And anyway, that's another conversation. But yeah, he's very upset. He's worked very hard throughout the night to save this kid's life. The kid dies. He goes on TV and he panics, and that makes other people panic. And when which forces the allocation of resources, it moves where people are getting vaccinated and how health workers are working, and it has all these effects that are far outsized of any influence that any single aid worker should have had, and certainly somebody who is so new to the country. And then the other shoe drops just a couple months later when there is a disease outbreak. And that disease outbreak is caused by, all scientific evidence shows, United Nations peacekeepers who were stationed far outside of the earthquake zone. They were Nepalese soldiers who had recently rotated in from Nepal, where there was an active cholera outbreak going on. And it took a very long time It actually took no time at all to figure out where this came from. It was pretty obvious. Epidemiology was basically born with this disease. Cholera is a waterborne disease. It travels through the contamination of food and water by fecal matter, which carry the bacteria. And it was pretty easy to trace it back to its source and figure out that it came from this one very small discrete area, that it must have been imported from outside of Haiti because there had never been a recorded case of cholera in the country before. And basically the only foreigners in this spot happened to be people who came from an active outbreak that very quickly showed to have a perfect match for the bacterial strain that was in Haiti. Even I could figure out what was going on.
And yet you were getting pushback from this Pugliese guy who is part of the UN, who's right. issuing bulletins, who's trying to cover his ass.
Right.
I mean, why do you think the UN was not willing to be transparent about this screw-up?
Well, it's obvious why they wouldn't want to be transparent, because they literally got caught with their pants down. It's extremely embarrassing. UN peacekeeping missions all over the world have been indicted for failure to protect in Rwanda and in Congo, and sex scandals with sex workers in the Balkans, and you name it. You know, the mission in Haiti was sort of a good example that they could bring up of a place that at the very least they just hadn't killed thousands of people until now. Now, obviously, it wasn't through direct action. It was through negligence. It's obvious why they wouldn't be held accountable or want to be held accountable. But the reason that they didn't have to be held accountable, and that it's taken so long for people to demand answers from them, and even still, it's kind of a niche story, even though, after 2.5 years since the outbreak, it's now, you know, in the New York Times and other places besides just our stories in AP and Al Jazeera and a very small handful of others. One of the reasons was this mythology that, of course, there's going to be a disease outbreak, because disease outbreaks always follow disasters. Never mind that there were 9 months intervening and that the outbreak happened in a totally different part of the country than the earthquake struck. And because Haiti is inherently diseased, so of course there would have been this outbreak. And it was that mythology that has enabled, in part, the UN to avoid accountability ever since.
There's one fascinating part of the book that I really had no idea about in terms of Haiti, and that is how aid coming into the country actually destroys the Haitian healthcare infrastructure. You've got the general hospital. Yes, it's rat infested, but nevertheless, doctors who are doing public work there are also doing private practices so they can actually supplement their income and so that they are able to afford doing their work at the public hospital. When aid comes in from the outside, however benevolent, it actually puts these doctors out of business, and this general hospital closed. And of course, there was some problems in terms of Prevail actually reimbursing this hospital for costs suffered during the quake.
Well, that was a clinic, but it was a private clinic that was associated. But yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but I guess my question in relation to this is, why is the UN and other countries and other NGOs incapable of understanding that there's actually a long-term effect here, that a short-term burst, which we all understand to be helpful in some sense, results in this crumbling of infrastructure, and that actually we see this terrible domino effect that is actually going to affect Haiti, I think, based off of your book, for the next several years?
It's a beautiful question to which I wish I knew the answer. I mean, I can take some educated guesses. I mean, one thing is that it's not so bad for us. Like, the system basically works for us. There are large development and aid organizations in the United States that get billions of dollars from the United States government to do work in Haiti and other countries. Whenever there's an emergency, there's another thing for them to do, and they keep doing it. And they spend thousands of dollars every year lobbying Congress for more money, and they get it. For them, why would the system change? Like, you know, all a general hospital or a private hospital such as the one that closed in Port-au-Prince after the earthquake are really, I mean, I don't, well, this is cynical, but like all they are is competition, really. I'm not saying that there are bad people who staff these organizations and that they're sitting in a back room in Maryland hatching a plot to get rid of local healthcare.
This is all subconscious. They don't really realize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's, you know, and even people who see it happening in front of them on the ground, maybe they report back to Maryland or New York or Paris or wherever, and their bosses don't care all that much. It's not really their problem. And maybe they don't stay for long enough to even see it themselves. I mean, the thing is, the idea, and it has been said over and over again, including by Bill Clinton and by aid workers, is that their goal is to put themselves out of business. But nobody's goal is really to put themselves out of business, and they don't. I think that's one of the major things that we have to look at differently when we look at international aid. We want to highlight the goodwill, and it's true, it is there. We want to highlight our personal desire to help and the fact that we donate to these organizations because we are good and caring people who are trying to share. And all those things are true, and all those things can be harnessed in a very different way. But we also need to consider that there are other factors in play. There is profit motive. There is a status quo that a lot of people are profiting from. And that's one of the big reasons why it's so hard to change.
But as you dryly observe in the book, when Bill Clinton is in Haiti, it's almost as if to atone for one of his mistakes during his presidency. He's also tremendously energized, as you describe him in the book, while he is in Haiti. Surely a guy with this much experience is going to be at least dismally aware of the long-term impact or the present infrastructure in Haiti. And my curiosity is if even the veterans of Haiti, from an aid standpoint, can't recognize this. I mean, you know, why? I mean, it just seems to me that this is something that a guy who's as smart as Bill Clinton would actually figure out. It can't be entirely profit is motivating him.
No, but a status quo that people benefit from can be reason enough. Not, I mean, changing the status quo is always difficult, and if you have even a small incentive not to change it, it's not going to change. Bill Clinton is, obviously, this goes without saying, an exceptionally brilliant man. He could sit here and probably give you the exact same interview that I am, you know, telling you about all the problems. I mean, he is always out in front. This has always been one of his talents going back to his political career. But he will come out and surprise you every time. He said in March of 2010, and I wrote a story about it at the time, you know, he came out and made these comments in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about how U.S. food policy in Haiti, including that under his administration.
The rice,
exactly, that heavily subsidized, I mean, we're talking Soviet-style subsidies for American agriculture that artificially deflate the price.
In Arkansas under his watch.
And he said, I mean, he sat there in the Senate and said, you know, it may have benefited some of my farmers in Arkansas, but it was a mistake. And he says that it is his mistake and he takes personal responsibility. But this is Clinton. This is what he does. He still has his eye on his own goals. And he still comes in and makes sure that those goals happen. And, you know, if there are mistakes that are made this time, I would say that there almost certainly are, I wouldn't be surprised if, in, you know, 10 or 15 years, if Bill Clinton is still around and is still involved with Haiti, he's giving another speech about the mistakes that were made then while plugging his new project. I'm not saying he's a hypocrite. I'm not saying any of that. What I'm saying is that he has his own particular view of the world, and it's a very strong view. It is that the most productive way for poor countries to emerge from poverty is through private and public partnerships. Basically between governments he likes and companies he likes, because of course people like the things that they like, and to plug in those countries to a global system which is recognizable to him. And in Haiti, that has taken the form of a big push from Bill Clinton, among others, to reopen the assembly sector, low-wage garment factories, sweatshops, whatever people want to call them, to produce for export to the United States under tariff-eliminating legislation that Bill Clinton has successfully lobbied to push through Congress. And that's his vision of the world. That's how he thinks that he can do well. I think it's a goodwill. I think he also knows that the right people in his mind are going to benefit from that financially. And that's the situation. Everybody's doing what they think is right, but not everybody thinks the same way.
So are you imputing that Clinton's vision of the world doesn't account for a innate Haiti infrastructure that could actually help possibly get the country going, that it's all about contractors, export processing zones, the like?
The impression that I get is, and again, this is nuanced, it's subtle, and Bill Clinton is a master of nuance and subtlety. A reporter will come in with a very simple storyline, and he will complicate it to the point that nobody can understand it anymore, and then come back in and lay it back over with his narrative. He's very good at what he does. He will tell you, I mean, you will listen to him talk, and he will praise Haitian national institutions. He will say that Haitians need a sustainable national food sector. But his actions are always to augment that with, you know, so for instance, agriculture is an example. He will sit there and he will say, as he did at the donors conference in 2010, and as he has in countless interviews and public appearances and private meetings since, Haiti needs national food security. Haiti needs a strong ability to feed itself. But in doing that, the way he wants to do it is to, for instance, increase mango exportation. The Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, Clinton Global Initiative selected projects, Clinton Foundation projects, improve mango processing and roads to port so you can import mangoes. And then he helped broker a deal at that same donors conference with Coca-Cola so that Coca-Cola could make an Odwalla product using Haitian mangoes. It's a very American view of the world. And it's maybe a view of the world that everybody holds for their own country, that let's start here. Let's get our guys involved too. So for Bill Clinton, there's no contradiction between making money for Coca-Cola, having a good project that gives a good headline for the Clinton Foundation or the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, and creating national food security in Haiti. The problem is that the track record for those kinds of projects hasn't been good. Sit him down and he'll give you a response, and he'll probably tell you six reasons why I'm wrong. But that's what I've seen, and that's where research has led me.
While we're on the subject of the American way and money, I do actually want to talk to you about one of the great fallacies of our understanding of Haiti that you point out in the book, is the fact that there has ever been $16.3 billion to spend on anything. You point not only to Senator Richard Lugar and Washington's withholding of monies that were pledged to Haiti, but you also have these exorbitant costs that the U.S. spent elsewhere, $368,000 on hotel rooms and meals outside Haiti. You have $194,000 on photo and video equipment in a Manhattan store. Is this type of creative financing business as usual? Is this any different with which the Department of Defense tends to spend $225 on a screwdriver? Has Haiti typically received this lower spending priority on the whole compared to other countries?
The United States in general doesn't like giving money directly to foreign governments. I mean, we just don't do it. In 2009... oh, and I'm going to get the number in my own book wrong. It was something like, I think 1% of foreign aid was given as direct budget support, and all of it was given to in that year to Jordan and the Palestinian Authority. Obviously, that tied into the general Middle East situation, and both countries or both entities, obviously neighbor Israel. I guess they're both states now. So you're right. This is sort of business as usual in general. And, you know, a lot of those examples that you're talking about, Defense Department spending, like they have no problem in any circumstances, writing huge contracts and dumping tons of money on this and that. One thing that I would say, if not particular to Haiti, was certainly present in the case of Haiti, was the unexpectedness of the emergency, the emergency itself. That can lead itself to profligate spending because you are coming in and you're just like, well, what do we need? We need everything. We need photo equipment. We need to fix up the ship. We need the fuel and just go, go, go. Let's just get this contract and just go. You know, I don't know. And I tried to track this down, by the way. I had some fact checkers who were working with me on the book. And we tried very hard to get the Department of the Navy or the Pentagon to sit down with us and explain line by line, okay, what's this for, what's this for, what's this for? I covered the Pentagon in 2003 at the outbreak of the Iraq War, so I was under no illusion that we were going to get answers, and we didn't. But, but I can still imagine with regard to the photo and video equipment, you know, some Navy guys, maybe a contractor, maybe some sailors themselves come to New York. They're like, look, we're going down for this project. We're going to need audio and visual equipment so we can record it. Or even, you know, there's a great humanitarian need because we're going to, I'm just imagining here. I don't know if this is really what it was, but maybe even like we're going to take pictures of injured earthquake survivors and send those back to our doctors in the States so that they can direct. You know, maybe there's like a really good need, but you can
but
still
see. But
the
fact remains is there's no clear explanation for why you needed the photo and video equipment.
Exactly.
There's no transparency. There's no accounting. So as a result, we all get all gushy and giving.
Right.
And then years later, we have no idea how the money was spent.
Right. Nor is it clear why we would need to buy new cameras for this particular. I mean, doesn't the Navy have a camera somewhere like lying around that they could take down? It's a little weird that like they would have to buy like all this like audio visual equipment specifically for this mission, and they would bring it down. And regardless, this is the problem. The narrative, the perception that most of us have when we think about foreign aid, is that a rich country is giving something to a poor country. The United States is giving money to Haiti, and we're not. Even if you're buying cameras or a jungle gym or a deep fat fryer or any of these things that I mentioned for use in Haiti in this emergency, it is not money to Haiti. And so the perception that if something goes wrong, it must be because the money was stolen or because Haitians are corrupt is really wrongheaded.
It's more because the NGOs, the United States government authorities, and the various organizations that actually allocate the money are corrupt more so than the Haitians.
I don't even know if I would go. I don't even know if I would say corruption. I mean, I think there is corruption in the process. I think, and I don't think anybody would disagree that the lobbying industry and the lobbying process in this country is a form of legalized corruption. Maybe not in every instance or in every level, but it certainly is a way to trade money for influence. And what's more of a indication of corruption than that? But at the same time. It's not necessarily as simple as just, somebody at the Pentagon had sticky fingers and decided, hey, we can take advantage of these Haitian people or whatever to buy new rotor blades for our helicopters. I think what it is that, if you call the military and you say, we've got a crisis, guys, and you need to get down there and help, they say, okay, we're going to go. But, you know, same thing with me as a journalist. Like, you know, I'm going somewhere on a story. I land on the ground. Yeah, maybe I'm brave or stupid or something for having flown in. And maybe I'm working hard and maybe I'm doing a good job. Maybe I'm even doing some good. But like, yeah, I'm going to keep the receipts for my meals. I'm going to keep the receipts for my taxis. I'm going to send those back to my editor. And you better believe I want them to pay them. And so, you know, the State Department calls the U.S. Army to go down to Haiti and save lives. They're going to keep track of the fuel that they spend. They're going to keep track of the man hours. They're going to keep track of the equipment that they need, and they are going to expect to be reimbursed. That's fine. The problem is it's twofold. First of all, we have to decide if those are the expenses that are incurred in responding to a disaster and going to help somebody, are those the things that we want to spend money on? Is that the most effective way for this money to be spent? Could we spend far less money and go through national channels, support national institutions, and in some instances, you know, have cost savings that way? And then the other thing is that we just have to be honest with ourselves about what the money was spent on. It's not that somebody at the Pentagon should be, you know, rounded up and charged and tarred and feathered or whatever, or even accused of corruption for having done this. But at the same time, we can't, after having spent money profligately like that on our own stuff and our own companies and our own equipment, say, but Haiti, we gave you all this money. What did you do with it?
Yeah. So have the people of Haiti, mm-hmm. who are often rightly, governmentally at least, accused of hoarding some of the money or inflating the prices or taking a cut, have they caught wind of this tendency of American money to do more or less the same thing?
Well, it's funny. From the Haitian perspective is interesting. Obviously, there isn't one Haitian perspective, nor can I be a spokesman for the people of Haiti. But One of the things that's interesting is that Haitians often take the same wrong-headed view that Americans do, that foreign aid is a powerful country giving money to a poor country. And when the aid doesn't reach them, or when they feel that they haven't been sufficiently helped, given the expectation put out there by the numbers that have been floated, they also think that perhaps somebody has stolen the money. And by the way, they may be likely to blame their own government as well. The Haitian government is the easiest scapegoat in any of this. Nobody... Everybody hates their own government, right? Americans, Congress's approval rating is lower than journalists and lawyers and I think a couple species of plankton.
Like, but in Haiti, it's the shortest distance between two points.
Exactly. Yeah. And everybody can blame them. Because, Americans can blame their government, but then the American government can blame the Haitian government. And Haitians can blame their own government. And when, you know, even though the Haitian government is getting something on the order of like 1% of the money that's being spent on reconstruction, and it depends at the moment that you take a snapshot, but that was the case when I was finishing up the book. Even if that's the total sum that they've collected, and so even if they had stolen every penny of it and bought a Cadillac Escalade and drove it into the ocean to go visit St. Bart's, it wouldn't have impacted 99% of the money, but nonetheless, Congress and the State Department and the Haitian people and the American people can all sit around and stamp their feet and say, well, it must have been those Haitian officials. To quote a UN official from a totally different part of the book, you know how they are.
I also wanted to briefly touch upon the construction situation, the TARP controversy. Mm-hmm. You describe at the very beginning of the book the fact that many of the buildings in Port-au-Prince have been constructed from watered-down concrete and so forth. And you have this situation where the tea shelters, which exist, well, they're meant to be temporary, and then a number of Haitians move into these because there's no other place to go. I mean, if there is no dependable construction of buildings, you know, maybe this is a way of trying to get you, as our time whittles down, to describe what the future of Haiti is. No infrastructure, what future?
No infrastructure, what future is the exact right question. The future of Haiti is contingent on a whole bunch of things, forces seen and unseen, but known and unknown. But one of the big things is, and I think this is really one of the lessons of the reporting that I've done and of what I've tried to do here in the book, is that we have to try to do better. We have to take infrastructure seriously. We have to take institutions seriously. Aid and development cannot be done in a way that ignores not only local needs, but the best local ways of getting them done, and ultimately creates institutions, government and otherwise, that are able to handle crises on their own. If another earthquake struck Port-au-Prince today in the same spot on the same fault, and we can be fairly sure that whatever the next disaster is, it won't be the same one. But even if the exact same fault erupted again in the same place, Haiti would be as bad off today. We would see the exact same thing today that we did in 2010. And that is a pitiable legacy. It is pitiable for the wasted effort that people put in on Band-Aid solutions that ultimately weren't durable. It's pitiable because of wasted money that was spent either things that were only needed briefly or were wrong or could have been gotten more cheaply elsewhere. It would be a sad legacy, and we have to face it. That disaster is coming at some point. There will be a hurricane. There will be a who knows, an outbreak of a disease like cholera, or a resurgence of cholera, or another earthquake, or aliens. Like, I'm not even going to guess what it is. The problem is that Haiti is no better off today than it was 3 years ago, but the solution would be to learn from the mistakes of yet another disaster response and learn from the mistakes of yet another sad chapter in the relationship between Haiti and the U.S. or the global north and the global south.
But no one's capable of learning.
Everybody's capable of learning. We're all capable of learning. It's
well, learning versus acting.
Maybe. You know, it's hard for people to admit when they've done wrong, and criticism can be hard to take. Insofar as my book is a work of criticism, it's not even that necessarily every point would be right. I guess what I'm trying to say is they should all read my book, and then I don't know. It's really what it is. People should take a really hard look at themselves and a really hard look at the work that they do. If you're on the ground and you know you don't have any interaction with this except that every now and again when there's a disaster you pull out your checkbook or your iPhone and donate some money. The thing to do is to research, to be informed, to understand the limits of our own power, and the importance of emphasizing and augmenting the power of other people in other places to run their own lives. And instead of maybe as a knee-jerk response, you know, sending your $10 to the same organization that you always have, do more research, find out who is really working to make institutions stronger, and who is really working to make durable solutions that aren't just called durable solutions in the brochure, but really are durable. Call your congressman, tell them that you want things to be done differently, and maybe in that way we can all be part of the solution.
That's our show for this week. Tune in next week when we devote our attentions to rebellion. Why has Rosa Parks' rebellious identity been swept underneath the carpet of history? And what can Pussy Riot teach us about what it is to be alive? Find out on episode 5. Until next week, we encourage you to follow your ears. You never know what little nugget you might pick up. Our thanks to Occupy Sandy in Staten Island, Jean, Kay Goda, Karen, Dee, Drew and Charlotte, and Jonathan Katz. And don't forget to visit our website at followyourears.com for all our episodes. Remember, follow your ears. Curiosity is too essential to existence to ignore. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.